This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. The death toll from the Los Angeles wildfires has risen to 16 with 150,000 under evacuation orders. Crews racing to contain the flames before strong winds threaten landmarks like UCLA and the Getty Museum. And about those fire hydrants that ran dry, California U.S. Senator Adam Schiff telling ABC's This Week.
The governor's called for an independent review of why we didn't have enough water in places like the Palisades. There were also water pressure issues in Altadena. I support that independent review. I think we should go further and, frankly, do an independent commission.
Dozens were injured when two trams collided in France Saturday afternoon. Authorities say none of the injuries are critical. One of the trams was found derailed. A man was arrested Saturday in the unprovoked stabbing death of a 14-year-old Bronx, New York boy who was on his way to school the day before. Police say it was the suspect's second stabbing attack in a week. This is ABC News. Have you noticed? Lots of us are coughing and sneezing. Hospitals around the country dealing with a wave of respiratory illnesses. The CDC says more than half of the country, at least 35 states, are seeing high levels of flu, COVID, RSV, even the common cold. ABC's Morgan Norwood has more.
So far this season, the flu alone has sent more than 63,000 people to the hospital and caused at least 2,700 deaths, including 11 children. We're also expecting fresh numbers tomorrow. In Michigan, the situation is so serious that two major Detroit health systems are limiting visitors to help stop the spread of flu and RSV. Pediatric units especially overwhelmed, with some hospitals hitting 95% capacity.
Southwestern Mexico experiencing a 6.2 earthquake early today near the Colima-Michoacan border. While buildings swayed and residents rushed into streets, officials report no major damage or injuries. Dave Packer, ABC News.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. The beginning of the year means a new session for the Wisconsin State Legislature. Members of the State Senate and State Assembly were sworn into office on Monday, January 6th. There are a lot of new faces in that group, with 6 new members in the State Senate and 31 new representatives in the State Assembly. While Republicans will remain in the majority, that majority is now the smallest it has been in more than a decade. The days of the GOP's supermajority are over. After last year's elections under new, fairer maps, we'll see if those smaller majorities lead to more compromise in a legislature that's been dominated by the right for nearly 15 years. Just a handful of seats make the difference now between a Republican and Democratic majority, and there are many more opportunities now to bring accountability to legislators, especially those in competitive districts. And in a healthy democracy, that's the way things should be.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area and on our website at civicmedia.us. Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tome Olson. A Wisconsin cranberry farmer is on a mission to restore wetlands by building what he calls mock beaver dams. Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
Jim Hoffman says he got his interest in beaver dam analogs after helping a Nordic skiing buddy release an orphaned beaver on his property with a constructed lodge and a stuffed teddy bear for company.
And we dropped the beaver in it. The first thing he did is swim right down the culvert and started swimming around the pond. Unfortunately, that was the last we saw of the beaver named Broadus.
Mock beaver dams, as Hoffman calls them, can pool more than 500,000 gallons of water during floods. He says he hopes to mimic the natural features of beaver dams, including enhancing wildlife habitat, stabilizing eroded stream banks, and improving water quality. Wisconsin, like the rest of the country, has lost about half of its wetlands since the late 1700s, due in part to declining beaver populations. Hoffman explains beavers are regarded as a nuisance animal that regulators believe harm trout. State departments have gone so far as to contract with the federal government to wipe them out.
Conservation trout stamp dollars should not be used to blow up beaver dams. It should be used to encourage water quality projects such as what we're working on right now.
Few mock dam projects like these exist in the state. Wisconsin has strict regulations that make permitting expensive. Hoffman has spent $20,000 in the past year alone for his own permit. He hopes to work with the state's Department of Natural Resources to create a new permit that would allow other Wisconsin homeowners to build their own dams. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. This story was produced with original reporting from Bennett Goldstein for Wisconsin Watch.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Some flurries and light snow today. Accumulations will be well under an inch. Our winds turning to the northwest and some gusts up around 25 miles per hour. That will drive our temperatures downward into the lower 20s by the end of the day. Mostly cloudy, near zero overnight. It's 24 at our studios.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome the author of Building the Bucks, Jordan Tresky, and talk entertainment with Capital Times reporter Victoria Davis. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 till 8.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Matt and Air on Air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus Law Review, and yes, my name is Jim Santel. I am your host here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, both this hour and also the next hour, as we undertake now our weekly weekend review, our analysis, our deliberation, our assessment of those major news stories and events in the areas of government and law and the aspiration for justice here in Wisconsin, throughout our nation, and yes, indeed, across our planet as well. Delighted, honored that you have chosen to spend some time this weekend in conversation, in discussion, in engagement with me on some of these major issues. And there have been a lot of those just in this past week. We're going to get to those in just a few moments. My wonderful producer, Greg, here in the studios of Civic Media, also reminds me on a routine basis, most appropriately, that you can be a part of this discussion by calling in. Greg and I will take your calls at 855-752-4842. That number, once again, is 855-752-4842. Greg also reminds me that you can drop your comment, your question, your inquiry, your puzzlement about the world in which we live into the Civic Media Dropbox and be a part of our conversation that way as well. Once again, pleased and delighted that you are joining us for our discussion here on Amicus Law Review as we get into the major issues of this past week and beyond, and talk beyond that about the reasons why all of these things in the news are rule of law related. We come on the air, of course, this weekend very much mindful of the fact of what's going on in California right now. These incredible five blazes burning in and around the Los Angeles area. They've got names like the Palisades, which just last night moved into the Brentwood area, closer to that Brentwood area. The Eaton Fire, the Hearst Fire, the Kenneth Fire, the Archer Fire, the Lydia Fire, all of those in various stages of containment. Great tragedy out there, as many of them, most of them, not contained to this point. 37,000 acres of real estate under those fire warnings and watches being burned quite literally as we think about our colleagues, our residents, our fellow Americans out there in California. At least 11 people killed, a number that regrettably local authorities continue to indicate will almost certainly increase in the days and weeks ahead as the true devastation of what is going on out there becomes clearer to all of us. We know as well that this is not just a tragedy for human beings. That certainly is at the top of the list. The stories are almost unimaginably horrific. It is not just a story about a place in our nation on the face of this planet that is suffering deeply. And yes, indeed, that's got to be our first priority as we go forward to address this tragic situation. But it is also appropriately to think about it, begin to think about it as a rule of law issue as well. We already have seen some issues related to insurance coverage, things that will certainly be in the courts in the days and weeks and months and years ahead. We know as well that perhaps at the top of the list when it comes to things like this, these natural tragedies that happen in our nation, natural but perhaps prompted in many ways by our failure to this point to address climate change and the challenges of that. This is also an environmental justice issue. That's right. It's environmental justice as well as we think about the interplay between Mother Nature and rule of law for all people, including certainly at the top of the list, those people who are victimized most profoundly right now in those areas in and around Los Angeles. It is an issue. It is an event related to government involvement, too. The president has promised that major components of the costs of firefighting and certainly the cleanup will be borne by the federal government. But it's also a state government issue. It's a local government issue as monies are allocated to address this issue immediately and down the road. We talk a lot here on Amicus about victims of crime. There are also, of course, victims in other situations as well, including this one. Funds and programs needed to support the tragic losses suffered by human beings there in California. That too, a rule of law issue. All of that implicating issues that we talk about routinely and will continue to be on the focus of our agenda here on Amicus Law Review. Our thoughts are with those colleagues, those friends, those partners, those citizens, those fellow residents of the planet who are right now facing this terrible tragedy there in California. We continue to monitor not only the events out there, but also speak about the implications of what this means for our future in our nation and on the face of the planet. During the course of our last broadcast last weekend, we spent some initial time talking about one of the other major news stories, anticipating what did happen this past week, which is the National Memorial and the funeral and the burial of Jimmy Carter, our 39th president of the United States of America, promising in our last broadcast not only to return to that, but to provide the core of the memorial that I'm going to be presenting in this, our first segment, and into our second segment in response to the ways in which Jimmy Carter, our 39th president, changed our world. During the course of the pomp-filled state funeral and the events at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. just this past week, in addition to some amazingly moving and important speeches and remarks and reminiscences of many people, one of the former aides of the president said, "It's time to redeem his presidency." Indeed, it is. And that is the theme. That is the theme of my own reminiscence about Jimmy Carter. I told you last week, and I will recite again, my own marginal personal involvement with him. I had the great honor and pleasure and delight, one of the great honors and pleasures and delights of my life, to work, yes, as a lowly intern, a staff intern in something called the domestic policy staff of the White House. There is still such a thing inside the Department of Justice, inside the White House, inside other agencies. All of them focus upon domestic issues, but a special unit inside the West Wing called the domestic policy staff, led at that time by a fellow named Stuart Eisenstadt, one of Jimmy Carter's chief advisors and senior aides at the time. Stuart Eisenstadt spoke during the course of the memorial event of this past week about his former boss, talked about him as a Renaissance man who did not only all of these things related to government in Georgia, but also, of course, in the United States of America. And, of course, remember him most notoriously and famously for the wonderful things that he did following his time in the White House. But once again, the importance of focusing upon the accomplishments that were his during his time in the White House. I was there in the summer of 1980, a job that was given to me out of the largesse of another representative from Wisconsin. His name was Clemens Zablocki. He used to represent one of the districts in the Milwaukee area. I had worked on Capitol Hill for a couple of summers for Clemens Zablocki, again, as a lowly staff person responsible for some constituent engagement and every so often a little bit of legislative attention as well. A wonderful, terrific experience as well. It's a result of Clemens Zablocki and his association with Jimmy Carter at that time that I was wonderfully placed in this position of being an intern there, principally located in the very top floor, the seventh floor of the old executive office building, which is that huge castle-like building just adjacent to the White House to the west, which you see on the regular news on a regular basis. It's where many of the staff offices are placed beyond the West Wing in the White House itself. And during the course of that summer, I had not only an opportunity to see up front, close and personal, as we say, the operations of the White House, but to take the measure, if you will, of this amazing man, our 39th president, who, of course, at the time was headed for defeat that coming fall to Ronald Reagan, who was already running his campaign. Jimmy Carter, however, maintaining to the very end his commitment not only to the United States of America, but to the works that he had done and continued to do during the course of his term there. Among other things, as we commented last week, he brokered this wonderful, amazing peace accord between Israel and Egypt. That was the Camp David Accord. He established diplomatic relations with China, building upon many of the things that Richard Nixon had done to open up the Chinese diplomatic connection. Yes, he won the ratification of those treaties that are now back in the news. That's the Panama Canal Treaty that, by virtue of the payment of $1 to the Panamanian leadership, we turned over the responsibility for the international operation of that canal to Panama. As you know, continues to be in the news to this day as the incoming president talks amazingly, shockingly about the possibility of attempting to take that back. Jimmy Carter tried to move the country beyond the traumas of the previous decade, which he inherited. He pardoned Vietnam War draft dodgers and brought them home in large numbers. He ushered in many post-Watergate reforms, both legislatively and just in terms of changing the norms of our nation. We know well he created the Departments of Education and Energy, hugely important to the operation of our government to this time. He tackled energy policy, and that's going to be the principal focus of some of my remarks this weekend, that foreshadowed some of the very issues that we think about today, fossil fuels and climate change, part of our national discussion. Jimmy Carter talked principally about this in the context of energy, but thinking about the future of the planet. That was the way in which he was so forward-looking. He appointed a Federal Reserve chair that ultimately was responsible, the Federal Reserve itself, under a fellow named Paul Volcker, who began the deregulation of some industries and some military buildup, and also ultimately tamed some of the inflationary cycles that we still suffer to this day, but nonetheless attempted to resolve that and address that in a way that was for the good of the American public. We know as well there were setbacks during his tenure, the economic tumult of the time, the gas lines, the problems, of course, related to the 444 days that our diplomats remained in the custody, the control of the Iranian takeover at the embassy in Tehran. We know that well. And all of that did not soften, did not dampen Jimmy Carter's resolve to work on behalf of the people of our nation. During the course of the memorial service just this past week, we heard, of course, from many people, including the present president. His name is Joseph Biden. He said this. He said throughout Jimmy Carter's life, he showed us what it means to be a practitioner of good works, a good and faithful servant of God and of the people. Today, many think he was from a bygone era. This is President Biden speaking. But in reality, he saw well into the future. Yes, not only in those areas of economies, but also climate change and all of those other issues about which we will talk. And during the course of the next segment, talking more about the things said about Jimmy Carter, but also hearing from Jimmy Carter himself and the speech that he gave on July 15th of 1979 that reverberates to this day and should animate us as we go forward and think about the future of our nation, our state, and our world. All of that coming up in this edition of Amicus, a Law Review.
This is the talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM.
The possibility of lung cancer can be pretty scary, especially if you're one of approximately 8 million current or former smokers at high risk. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know that now there's a breakthrough low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early, and it only takes 60 seconds. You stop smoking, now start screening. For an easy quiz to see if you're eligible, visit SaveByTheScan.org. It could save your life. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
Matt Nair on Air.
It is our 1 year anniversary here on Matt Nair on Air. Thank you, Greg and Calvin, for being on this journey with me. It's been great.
Thanks for having me. I can't speak for Calvin.
I'm always thrilled to be here.
Unbridled.
The enthusiasm
enjoyment.
Brimming over from you, Calvin. I'm overwhelmed. Thank you.
Matt Nair on Air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, Lacrosse's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a Law Review. My name, Jim Santel, here this hour and next hour as well. Broadcast stations of Civic Media inviting you to join my wonderful producer, Greg, and me at 855-752-4842. Be a part of our conversation. Call in, drop a comment, a question into our chat line, and be a part of our broadcast this weekend, spending the initial portions of our broadcast thinking once again about the 39th president of the United States of America, now laid to rest back in his home, his very modest home, near a willow tree where his beloved wife of many decades is also laid to rest. Her name, of course, Rosalynn Smith Carter. He is now buried at the place that he called home, Plains, Georgia, after having served the nation and the world. Indeed, doing much more than that. In his eulogy, President Biden said that Jimmy Carter's most enduring attribute was character, a trait that is maintained. It's missing. A trait that he has maintained is missing in his predecessor turned successor. Of course, that's what the president has repeatedly spoken about when it comes to the incoming president, Donald Trump. Joe Biden saying this: we are all fallible, but it's about asking ourselves, are we striving to do things, the right things? What value, he said, what are the values that animate our spirit? Speaking again about Jimmy Carter, he said, to operate from fear or hope, ego or generosity. Do we show grace? Do we keep the faith when it's most tested? For keeping the faith with the best of humankind and the best of America, President Biden said, is a story, in my view, from my perspective, of Jimmy Carter's life. Essentially, his grandson said, he eradicated a disease with love and respect. Jason Carter, his grandson, serving now also as the chair of the Carter Center, which Jimmy Carter created after leaving the White House. The grandson saying this: he waged peace with love and respect. He led this nation with love and respect. To me, this life was a love story from the moment he woke up until he laid his head. Tells some very interesting and humorous stories also. We know as well that Jimmy Carter was incredibly bright, perhaps one of the brightest people ever to occupy the White House, went to the Naval Academy at Annapolis, graduated 39th. Wanted to be a part of the Nuclear Submarine Initiative, that program, went to Admiral Rickover and got his permission to be a part of that initiative. He was a nuclear scientist, quite literally, Jimmy Carter, part of our nuclear submarine arsenal, if you will. And so that lays the groundwork for this very interesting and tongue-in-cheek story told by Jason Carter about the regular guy, Jimmy Carter. He described how his grandfather had decades-old fishing trophies. He greeted visitors wearing 1970s short shorts, Crocs. It was so frugal that he and Rosalind used zip bags, hung them out to dry after they had used them the first time. He told a story that many younger Americans and I and others can identify with. Grandfather apparently fumbling at some point with a newly acquired cell phone and accidentally called his grandson. The former president said, "Who's this?" And the grandson answered, "This is Jason." And Jimmy Carter said, "What are you doing?" And Jason said, "I'm not doing anything. You called me." And Jimmy Carter said, "I called you? I didn't call you. I'm taking a picture." And Jason Carter, of course, said that all of that represents the grandfather that he knew, and finished the story by saying, "This is from a nuclear engineer, right?" Of course, with some level of humorous sarcasm about his grandfather's pre-political role in the United States Navy. All of that, a part of the reminiscences of this past week. Tributes included those from former President Gerald Ford and former Vice President Walter Mondale, who wrote their eulogies before their deaths, anticipating that Jimmy Carter would precede them in death. That did not happen. They were read by their sons, Stephen Ford and Ted Mondale. In some folksy reminiscences that are similar to that of the grandson, Gerald Ford noted that Mr. Carter sometimes got under my skin, but called him this beloved man, this very special man who understood that defeat at the polls can be painful. Indeed, Jimmy Carter reminisced about that following the 1980 election that he lost to Ronald Reagan, but also can be very liberating, Gerald Ford wrote. "As for myself, Jimmy," Gerald Ford concluded, "I'm looking forward to our reunion. We have much to catch up on. Thank you, Mr. President. Welcome home, old friend." All of that coming from the reminiscences. Reverend Tony Loudon, the former president's personal pastor, seemed to allude to fears that Donald Trump does not fully subscribe to some of these basic traits that animated Jimmy Carter. He said this: "President Carter is giving us a lesson today in this moment," Reverend Loudon said, "on faith and hope to be the guardrails of our democracy." All that coming out of the national ceremony, the memorial service at the National Cathedral there just north of the downtown mall area in Washington, D.C. During the course of his presidency, of course, Jimmy Carter had many opportunities to give speeches, was around the country on a regular basis. He is known, of course, for many of those. And among the things that I made reference to earlier, I want to invite our attention to, was his focus on energy policy. I was there in the summer of 1980 when he not only signed the Energy Act of that year, but also gave out awards for people who in that time were already focusing upon ways in which we can preserve our energy, preserve our natural resources to keep us all safe and secure for decades to come. As a result of that, of course, Jimmy Carter not only was focused upon energy at the time, but thinking about climate change in ways that we would recognize today. On July 15th of 1979, he gave a speech, hugely controversial, sometimes called the malaise speech, a word he never used, but described that way by various pundits and news people who later on talked about this extraordinary way, atypical way in which a president began to address us, talking specifically about energy and national goals, but using that, using his focus upon the future of America's safety and security, to talk about the government actions and the roles that all of us need to play to ensure that we are safe and secure, yes, for energy and other reasons. He said this. This is Jimmy Carter, again, from the Oval Office on July 15th of 1979. He said, "I know, of course, being president, that government actions and legislation can be very important. That's why I've worked hard to put my campaign promises into law." And he says, "I have to admit, with just mixed success." That's the humility of this man. "But after listening to the American people," he went on, "I've been reminded again that all the legislation in the world can't fix what's wrong with America. So I want to speak to you first tonight about a subject even more serious than energy or inflation. I want to talk to you right now about a fundamental threat to American democracy." He said, "I do not mean our political or civil liberties. They will endure." That from Jimmy Carter. He said, "And I do not refer to the outward strength of America, a nation that is at peace tonight, everywhere in the world. Indeed, during his term of office, no hostilities, no wars during those 4 years. An unmatched economic power, he reminded the nation, and military not might. He said the threat is nearly invisible in ordinary ways. Here's the language. He said it's a crisis of confidence. It's a crisis that strikes at the very heart and soul and spirit of our national will. We can see this crisis in the growing doubt about the meaning of our own lives and the loss of a unity of purpose for our nation. As we continue more of Jimmy Carter's words on July 15th of 1979, in many ways he speaks to us to this day in January of 2025 about the future of America. Stay with us for more of Jimmy Carter speaking to us in this time here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to the Talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. The death toll from the Los Angeles wildfires has risen to 16 with 150,000 under evacuation orders. Crews racing to contain the flames before strong winds threaten landmarks like UCLA and the Getty Museum. And about those fire hydrants that ran dry, California U.S. Senator Adam Schiff telling ABC's This Week.
The governor's called for an independent review of why we didn't have enough water in places like the Palisades. There were also water pressure issues in Altadena. I support that independent review. I think we should go further and, frankly, do an independent commission.
Dozens were injured when two trams collided in France Saturday afternoon. Authorities say none of the injuries are critical. One of the trams was found derailed. A man was arrested Saturday in the unprovoked stabbing death of a 14-year-old Bronx, New York boy who was on his way to school the day before. Police say it was a suspect's second stabbing attack in a week. This is ABC News.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
The Panthers beat the Phoenix. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Men's college basketball, UW-Milwaukee beat the UW-Green Bay Phoenix 70-59 at the Panther Arena in Milwaukee. Themis Folks led the Panthers with 14 points, scoring the 1,000th point of his college career. The Phoenix are now 2-16 and in last place in the Horizon League under first-year head coach Doug Gottlieb, who's taken some heat for maintaining his daily sports talk show while still trying to be Green Bay's head coach. Gottlieb on why his team has lost 13 in a row.
To answer your question, some of it's personnel-based. It's not for lack of work. I mean, the reason our offense went from the best offense in the league to whatever we were today, but we told them that this game comes down to two things, right here and below the belt. And they had both, and we had none. We're just going to have to find whomever it is that wants to compete when that ball gets thrown up.
That's Green Bay head coach Doug Gottlieb with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price, and flurries and light snow. Today, accumulations will be well under an inch. Our winds turning to the northwest and some gusts up around 25 miles per hour. That will drive our temperatures downward into the lower 20s by the end of the day. Mostly cloudy, near zero overnight. It's 24 at our studios.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo signed automatic voter registration into law in December of 2020 to begin in January of 2023. Pandemic, technical, and bidding delays ensued, but preparation for voter registration at the DMV and other state agencies has finally begun. The New York State Board of Elections approved a resolution in December 2024 authorizing the state's Department of Motor Vehicles and other state agencies to create voter registration forms and transmit that data to the Board of Elections database. The new system allows citizens to opt out of voter registration, but will otherwise register or change registration information during official transactions. Gotham Gazette reports that both the implementation of automatic voter registration, or AVR, and online voter registration, or OVR, were delayed as technical staff was diverted for pandemic-related IT projects. While the delays are frustrating, getting it right is critical.
Early adopter Oregon recently discovered flaws in its very successful AVR system, with evidence that ineligible citizens and non-citizens were accidentally registered during state transactions. The state is in the process of a system-wide audit. Brennan Center for Justice finds AVR has increased voter registrations from 9% to 94% in jurisdictions around the country. We have more on AVR at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
The Todd Alba Show.
Donald J. Trump has been officially certified the winner of the 2024 election the way that the Constitution dictates. You see how simple that is? There's a vote, you certify the results, democracy moves on. You might not like the results. The person I wanted to have elected didn't win, but that's the way democracy works. Unlike 4 years ago on January 6th, where rioters stormed the Capitol.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2, on your local civic media radio station and on the app. Todd Alba.
Hey everybody, join us next time as we will look back on the weekend news happenings and also review the Packers game. And what lies ahead, if anything. Join us then.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays noon till 2.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Coming back in 5.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. I'm your host this hour, next hour also. Here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, you can be a part of our broadcast at 855-752-4842. Greg and I in the studios of Civic Media, taking those phone calls, taking those inquiries about the subject matters on our agenda, ambitious but achievable, as always, here in Amicus Law Review, spending a good deal of time this weekend in reminiscence and in memory of Jimmy Carter, my own involvement, very, very tangential, of course, as a lowly intern, a staff intern in the summer of 1980, but there to watch and witness in many ways real and important the commitment that Jimmy Carter, this president of ours, had to our nation, speaking to our nation in July of 1979 about energy ostensibly, but then also talking about the crisis in confidence, a speech that many of his staff did not want him to give. It certainly is a graphic speech about some of the concerns and challenges that the president identified at that time that frankly continue to animate us to this day. He talked a lot about disrespect for government. He talked about paralysis and stagnation and drift, all those kinds of things that in many ways people say because of the way in which he cast the concerns that he had led to his own defeat at the hands of Ronald Reagan, who described an America that probably was unreal, certainly was unreal in terms of the overwhelming optimism on that side of the political aisle. Jimmy Carter trying to balance that and saying we do have challenges, we do have problems, and yet we can address them. And that's the point of this speech overall. He said the symptoms of this crisis in America are all around us, but they can, in fact, be solved. He says we are at a turning point in our history. And this is where in the speech he takes this notion of malaise, a word he never actually says in the speech, and describes how we can overcome that. He says there are two points to choose, offering, again, some instruction for us even today. One is a path I've warned about tonight, the path that leads to fragmentation and self-interest. Down that road lies a mistaken idea of freedom, the right to grasp for ourselves some advantage over others. What important words to take in today. That path would be one of constant conflict between narrow interests ending in chaos and immobility. It is a certain route to failure. All the traditions of our past, all the lessons of our heritage, Jimmy Carter told America in July of 1979, all the promises of our future point to another path, the path of common purpose and the restoration of American values. That path, he said, leads to true freedom for our nation and ourselves. We can take the first steps down that path as we begin to solve our energy problem. Again, weaving the challenges of the day to and inspiration to America to be better than it was. He said the solution to our energy crisis can also help us conquer the crisis of the spirit in our country. It can rekindle our sense of unity, our confidence in the future, and give our nation and all of us individually a new sense of purpose. He said this. He said, you know we can do it. We have the natural resources. We have more oil in our shale alone than several Saudi Arabias. We have more coal than any nation on earth. We have the world's highest level of technology. We have the most skilled workforce with innovative genius. And I firmly believe, he said, that we have the national will to win. Finally, he said this, little by little, we can indeed rebuild our confidence. We can spend until we empty our treasures, and we may summon all the wonders of science. But we can succeed only if we tap our greatest resource, American people, America's values, and America's confidence. I have seen, he said, the strength of America in the inexhaustible resources of our people. Jimmy Carter said, in the days to come, let us renew that strength in the struggle for a secure nation. In closing, he said, let me say this. I will do my best, but I will not do it alone. Let your voice be heard. Wherever you have a chance, say something good about our country with God's help and for the sake of our nation, Jimmy Carter said. It is time for us to join hands in America. Let us commit ourselves together to a rebirth of the American spirit, working together with our common faith. We cannot fail. Jimmy Carter's commission to us in the late 1970s, and certainly over the decades, in the 45 years since then, words to think about as we enter into another new time in America. And that, of course, is the presidency of Donald Trump in just 9 short days. Donald Trump on the west side of the Capitol, taking the oath to the Constitution of the United States of America, taking an oath, as Jimmy Carter would say, to support and defend and safeguard the safety, the security of the people of our nation. Donald Trump, of course, the juxtaposition of this wonderful reminiscence of Jimmy Carter this past week. Donald Trump also in the news in ways big and small this past week. Let's talk about a couple of those as well. Also, important rule of law issues, justice issues as well. Almost a split screen this past week. Triple screens, if you will, between Jimmy Carter and the horrific fires in California, but Donald Trump issues as well in at least 2 major areas. One is Donald Trump now becoming at the entrance of a judgment in that New York case for the first time in history. A former president, a future president, now identified legally, historically, not just technically, but realistically as a convicted felon. He is now a felon that by virtue of the jury verdict, yes, way back in May, 7 months ago, we knew that that was the case. An awful lot of things have happened since that time. But with the rendition this past week, the imposition of a sentence upon him, which is what we do in America after a defendant has been found guilty, if indeed a jury or a judge finds a defendant guilty, if there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt, if there's unanimity inside a jury, we then move to sentencing, not without opportunities to be heard between a verdict and the sentencing. And Donald Trump, of course, given all of those opportunities in the past 7 months. But with the result this past week, the imposition of a sentence, what's called an unconditional release. And yes, that means that what Juan Merchan, the presiding judge, did was he brought this case to an end, as he should, as we have maintained on this broadcast and others. That's the normal course of events. That's the rule of law in America. That's what happens to all defendants in our state system, in our federal system. After being convicted, they are subject to a sentencing proceeding. And indeed, that's exactly what Juan Merchan did late this past week, imposing this unconditional release sentence upon Donald Trump. Now, what does that mean? Obviously, the source of an awful lot of conflict, even to this point. Why? Because it means that Donald Trump suffers no jail time, no custodial situation, no fines, no monetary, no financial aspect of this, does not have to be supervised in any way by a probation officer. Basically, it is a finding. It's a confirmation of the judgment. It's an affirmation of the criminal status of Donald Trump, and then closing out the file. It is now time to close out that file. And of course, we'll talk as well about what happens next in all of this. But before we get to that, let's talk about what happened in that Manhattan courtroom. Again, history that our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren will be reading about in the history books, because it's never happened before in 248 years of American history. Donald Trump, of course, appearing, frankly, being given an accommodation, yet another one that Juan Merchan provided to him, appearing from Mar-a-Lago on the screen, if you will, by a Zoom connection. Donald Trump, of course, appearing there with his counsel. His name is Todd Blanchard, and that individual, that person, as we know, is also going to be nominated, presumably is going to be confirmed to be the Deputy Attorney General of the United States of America, now sitting next to the president, the future president, serving as his criminal defense attorney. Donald Trump appearing remotely in New York by virtue of the electrons coming across the nation 1,000 miles away into that chilly Manhattan courtroom from his estate in Mar-a-Lago, Florida. So what happens? Of course, again, the presiding judge, he's called Justice Juan Merchan, begins by saying some things about the truly significant nature of what's going on here. He said, he described capping this years-long ordeal that really consumed the nation and plainly focused all of our attention on that trial back in May. He said, never before has this court been presented with such a unique and remarkable set of circumstances. This has truly been an extraordinary case. Explaining the leniency that he did impose and signaled he would impose even in scheduling this proceeding, a justice or Judge Merchan acknowledged that Donald Trump's inauguration just 10 days later, did in fact have an influence upon that decision. He said that an unconditional discharge, that is simply getting rid of the case, closing it out without any further penalties being imposed, he said was the only way to avoid encroaching on the highest office of the land. Certainly something that is controversial. Many people saying that indeed you could have imposed a sentence of some imprisonment or some fine and let the appellate process take its course, staying that judgment while Donald Trump is in the White House. That is not to be. Juan Merchan saying, no, I'm not going to do that. He did, in fact, go on and talk about the many protections he provided Donald Trump, contrary to what Donald Trump has said. He said it's the legal protections afforded to the office of the president of the United States that are extraordinary, not the occupant of the office. That's Judge Merchan speaking. He said those protections are a legal mandate he had to respect. That is the judge having to respect all of those. And of course, as he's imposing this sentence, he is not only affirming the notion that Donald Trump got something in this proceeding that probably most, if not all, other criminal defendants, the state system, the federal system, have not been afforded in America. And that is these accommodations, not only for his language, both in the courtroom, especially outside of the courtroom. We know that Judge Juan Merchan did impose not a gag order, Donald Trump not gagged from speaking, but rather restricted from criticizing the very system that he's a part of, the system that he's now going to swear to uphold in about 9 days from now. That is the judicial system, our rule of law system. Juan Merchan saying these attacks upon the judicial system, on the jury, on the court staff, on the witnesses, on the trappings of this procedure cannot go on, found Donald Trump in contempt of court on routine bases and imposed some very low-level fines upon him. And, of course, all of that comes in the wake of that trial itself, the jury finding Donald Trump, let us remember, guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, 34 counts of violations of the criminal law of New York State. This is a state prosecution. That decision being made by a unanimous jury of 12 people, finding that beyond a reasonable doubt, all of these kinds of things, not the product of the Biden administration, not the product of the DA, whose name is Alvin Bragg, not the product of the judge, but nonetheless, important thing to underscore, the product of the jury itself. Donald Trump, of course, in the course of the process, which is the sentencing procedure, has the right to address the judge. And indeed, he did on screen. He did address the judge. He said, this has been a very terrible experience, Donald Trump said, about during a 6-minute speech, fairly rambling, fairly as we have come to get used to our former and future president pretty much undefined in terms of the structure of it. He said, the fact is I'm totally innocent. And once again, described the case as an injustice of justice. He asserted that the primacy of his electoral victory over the jury's verdict was the all-important thing to keep in mind. He told the judge that the voters had watched the case in your courtroom. They got to see this firsthand, and then they voted. Of course, in reality, the trial not accessible on television, but reported quite dramatically in all of our news media. Donald Trump, again, not so much denying the specific facts of the case, maintaining he's innocent, and maintaining instead that all of this was, yes, that's the word once again, a witch hunt that he was involved in. The judge said that regardless of Donald Trump's power and celebrity, once the courtroom doors were closed, this is Juan Merchan speaking again during the course of the trial itself, he said, was no more special, unique, or extraordinary than the other 32 trials that took place in this courtroom at the same exact time. Basically saying, once again, Donald Trump, you are not above the law. I treated you, Juan Merchan is saying, in the same way that all the other litigants, civil and criminal litigants, were treated in those other proceedings. The prosecutor, of course, also has a right to speak, and indeed, that's exactly what happened. As Amicus Law Review continues, we'll hear from the prosecutor what he said, and then some final observations about the importance of what happened just this past week in that Manhattan courtroom. Stay with us here on Amicus Law Review.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for the Todd Allball Show.
Do you hear that? Asthma triggers are everywhere, from dust mites, pet dander, and pollen, to smog and smoke. An asthma attack can strike anywhere, anytime. Be prepared with quick-acting Primatene Mist. Clinically proven to open airways quickly. It's the number one FDA-approved asthma inhaler available over-the-counter. Primatene Mist. Breathe easy again. Use as directed.
Are you ever questioning when life will slow down? Are you ever thinking of just relaxing and enjoying the simple things? All of this is possible, even while still being in the workforce. Worthington, Minnesota is a town growing, yet it's nothing like metro life. Professional and labor jobs, a beautiful lake, bike trails, recreation, acres of public hunting, festivals, and great people. Slow down. We're just a short drive away, so come join us. Worthington, it's worth a look.
Eagle 1490 AM.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. We are talking in these final moments of our first hour here on our broadcast all about this major rule of law event, this justice-related event that happened in a Manhattan state courtroom just this past week, and that is the imposition of a criminal sentence upon a former president. His name is Donald Trump. He is also our future president, and in about 8 or 9 short days, he is going to be the next president of the United States of America. Stunning, shocking in many ways that is the history that is now in the books for our children, our grandchildren to read. During the course of this process, this sentencing process, again, the rule of law taking hold there in that Manhattan courtroom for Donald Trump, as it is for any other defendant in America, the judge not only speaking about the reason for imposing this unconditional release sentence, but also affording Donald Trump the opportunity to speak. That's called the right of allocution. Tell me, Mr. Defendant, tell me, Madam Defendant, what it is you want me to know before I impose sentence upon you. And again, typically, defense counsel has an opportunity to speak, as happened here. And the defendant, also Donald Trump, speaking to Juan Merchan, in those words, denying any culpability and indicating once again that the rule of law was not upheld here. This is a great injustice of justice, he said. Along the way, of course, the prosecution also has an opportunity to speak to the judge, to speak to the world. The prosecutor, again, speaking on behalf of Alvin Bragg, his name is Joshua Steinglass. He is an assistant district attorney in Manhattan. Recap the overwhelming evidence introduced at trial that, yes, prompted the jury to come back with this unanimous verdict beyond a reasonable doubt, all 34 counts guilty of that those felonies described in the course of this false statement, false representations, fraudulent records case there, and also a case involving election interference going way back to 2016. The prosecution had indeed supported the recommendation, the approach of unconditional discharge, itself unusual under these circumstances. No penalties imposed at all. There was one of those situations that Juan Merchan was talking about. He says, I did that because of the presidency itself, not because of this defendant who occupies or will occupy the presidency. But Steinglass still blasted Donald Trump. He said, far from expressing any kind of remorse, indeed, the remorse was absent from Donald Trump's statement. Far from expressing any kind of remorse for his criminal conduct, this defendant has purposefully bred disdain for our institutions and the rule of law. He went on, he said that Donald Trump has caused enduring damage to the public perception of the criminal justice system and has placed the officers of this court in harm's way. That, of course, making a nod, that's a reflection of the problems during the course of the trial when Donald Trump's really relentless attacks on the prosecutors, the judges, the staff, the participants, the jury, the witnesses, all of them during the course of that trial. The 33-minute sentencing came and went. Judge Merchan, in a fairly subdued epilogue to all of this, had signaled, of course, in advance what he was going to do. But before and after this allocution by the defendant, by these statements by the prosecution, he was also focusing on being, as he said, supremely protective of Donald Trump's rights, but out of a commitment that that's the right thing to do. He said, I'm duty-bound to apply the rules of law even-handedly. Even so, to this day, an awful lot of people wondering if Donald Trump, again, sentenced a whopping 7 months, 7 months after being found guilty. All of that, again, during the course of that period of time, the court entertaining post-trial motions on immunity and decisions about whether or not the sentencing can go ahead at all based upon the fact that he will be our next president. All of that, affording this defendant an awful lot of latitude. An awful lot of people say that even the antics during the trial would have landed an awful lot of defendants in custody for failures to abide by the directions of the court. Back on the social media, of course, Donald Trump, after the sentencing, once again calling Judge Merchan a highly conflicted judge, something he repeated during the course of the trial, and suggested, of course, that justice should require that this judge should be ousted, and that because of all sorts of conflicts not identified, certainly by anyone in a position of responsibility, should not have presided over this case to begin with. Justice Merchan, in the end, did not use this sentencing to respond to those kinds of invectives in kind. Instead, after calmly outlining the rationale, again, some of the language we've recited here today, he simply bid Donald Trump farewell. He said this, "Sir, I wish you Godspeed as you assume your second term in office." He got up and he left the bench. That's what happened in Manhattan this past week. And of course, there's more that's going to happen. Very likely that Donald Trump will appeal this final judgment now entered by Judge Merchan. You might say, gee, what's there to appeal? And the answer is there is still this convictions on the book. There's a judgment that was entered plainly by Judge Juan Merchan this past weekend. So you can appeal that to an appeals court, arguably then to the highest court in New York State, to the highest court there, challenging things that went on. The judgment of conviction remains, and that is the focus, presumably, of an appeal that could be perfected, could be pursued in the days just ahead. Highly likely that will happen. Can that go ahead while Donald Trump is the president of the United States of America? Absolutely. As we have stated on this broadcast and others multiple times, Donald Trump does not need to be present for the appellate proceedings in the appeals courts in New York or perhaps even beyond. He can go about his life as our next president, his personal life as well, without having to be present. He will have to have lawyers to represent him, as I indicated. Some of the lawyers who have been representing him in these cases, in including John Sauer, the attorney who represented him in the Supreme Court, about to become our Solicitor General. Todd Blanche, who is also there sitting next to him at the sentencing, going to go on to be the Deputy Attorney General of the United States of America. Others also taking positions in the Department of Justice will not be able to represent Donald Trump as those appeals go forward because they plainly cannot have a divided allegiance. They need to represent the people of the United States of America and no more the personal interests of Donald Trump, but that does not preclude Donald Trump from going ahead with those appeals. In the end, plainly, a very mixed bag. Rule of law certainly supported in bringing this matter to an end, but also giving Donald Trump an awful lot of accommodations and other expressions of largesse by this judge that would not be afforded many defendants in the United States of America, raising once again the question of whether or not we do indeed have a president who is above the law. As some Supreme Court justices have said, do we have a king in 9 or 10 days who is above the law and that the law does not affect him? Those kinds of issues, the subject of an awful lot of continued analysis here on Amicus Law Review as we go into our second hour here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, LaCrosse's home for Up North News Radio.
Pat Kreitlow.
Monday morning, we'll talk to Judge Susan Crawford, candidate for Wisconsin Supreme Court, on defending a progressive seat against Scott Walker's attorney general.
Up North News with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday mornings starting at 6.
Progressive knows finding your new home was a dream come true. You wanted a colonial with high ceilings, hardwood floors, and a peaceful neighborhood. And you found it. Now, every Saturday at 6 a.m., you get to wake to the sound of your neighbor's leaf blower. Progressive can't save you from your noisy neighbors, but we can save you money when you bundle your home and auto with us. Get a quote at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company affiliates and other insurers not available in all states.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us. Soaring high above LaCrosse. This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX LaCrosse. And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Strong winds returning to Southern California despite progress in fighting wildfires across Los Angeles. ABC's Alex Perche is in hard-hit Pacific Palisades.
The good news for firefighters is that right now I'm standing outside. Those winds that have been really kind of thwarting a lot of these efforts to beat back these flames right now, there are none. But there is concern for more of that later on.
The death toll now at least 16. Search and recovery operations are underway. Cadaver dogs are helping to assist. A new executive order from Governor Gavin Newsom to cut construction red tape to speed up rebuilding of scorched neighborhoods in Los Angeles. The Supreme Court likely to uphold a TikTok ban unless owner ByteDance can find a U.S. buyer for the app deadline January 19th. White House says President Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke today about negotiations for a ceasefire in Gaza. This is ABC News.